From wherever you are around the world, welcome to the Circle of Insight Briefings. I'm your host, Dr. Carlos. Today we have a briefing on thinking like a terrorist with former undercover FBI agent Michael German. He's the author of a fabulous book called Thinking Like a Terrorist, Insights of a Former FBI Undercover Agent. He's also a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School. You can find more about Michael German at Rethink Intel. That's his Twitter handle, at Rethink Intel. Well, let's not waste any more time and welcome Mr. German to the show. Welcome, sir.
Thanks very much for having me, Dr. Carlos.
And would you like me to address you as Mr. German or Michael?
Mike's great.
Okay. So, Mike, tell us a little bit about your book, Thinking Like a Terrorist.
So, I wrote the book. It was published in 2007, mostly because everything I learned about terrorism came directly from terrorists. I started doing undercover work in the early 90s and infiltrated neo-Nazi groups and anti-government militia groups and many other criminal organizations. But what I was frustrated by as an agent is that there was very little in the FBI's intelligence base, and certainly nothing really in the academic coverage of terrorism that accurately was describing what I was seeing in front of me every day.
Huh.
So I wrote the book after I resigned from the FBI, basically to try to alter the discussion a little bit, to try to understand terrorism in a very different way, and specifically to look at it as a methodology. In the 90s, when I first started doing the work, terrorism studies was broken into two sort of competing schools. One made up mostly of psychologists who argued that terrorism was the process of some mental defect, that there had to be some mental illness or other mental process that enabled people to commit such horrendous crimes. And the other school was political scientists who argued, a lot of the problem with the research is that terrorism is a very small slice of what is a larger picture when we're talking about political conflict, and that trying to understand why somebody would engage in this particular tactic is impossible unless you understand the total context of the political conflict in question. And by the end of the 90s, what they found was there was really no mental defect. That when they would study terrorist populations, they found that they weren't crazy. This wasn't the product of some mental illness. But rather than accept that, we moved on into this new phase where we talked about it as radicalization, which basically used some of the same terms, talked about, an ideological virus or an infection or a epidemic that would spread from one person to another. But it then took out any of the scientific diagnosis. So
interesting.
The purpose of my book was to try to talk about terrorism as a methodology, what it is the terrorists are trying to accomplish, because it's a lot easier to defeat them if we understand what they're trying to accomplish by their violent acts.
That's a great point, and I guess we'll be looking at that. And it seems like you're alluding as well that psychologists, political scientists, people on the ground like yourself, I guess we can call you like boots on the ground in a sense, have different pieces of the pie. Would that be accurate?
Mm-hmm. That's certainly part of the problem. I mean, part of the problem is that terrorism, by definition, is distinguished from other kinds of violent crime by its political nature or the assumed political nature of it. So because it's politicized, the response to terrorism and the study of terrorism is often itself highly politicized. And that's why, one of the big problems that I'm sure you're aware of is definitional. What are the semantics? What do we define as terrorism and not terrorism? And often it's intended to describe violence by people we don't like or types of violence we don't like, even though other groups that we do like engage in very similar activity, but we terrorism. That's either justifiable state violence or police violence or other kinds of violence. So, it sort of goes to that problem that if we're going to look at this, let's look at this as if the people engaged in it are actually rational actors, and then ask ourselves what is it that they're trying to accomplish, and how do we defeat them in accomplishing that goal.
That's a great point. You're kind of reminding me of the famous adage, I guess, in the terrorist world, one terrorist is somebody else's freedom fighter.
Exactly.
Let me ask you this question. What are some of the things that obviously we want people to read the book. I think that we're only going to touch the tip of the iceberg of thinking like a terrorist, but what are some of the distinctions that you noticed when you were undercover? Something that you said, wait a minute, this isn't coinciding with the research or with whatever literature you've read on terrorism.
And my first case involved neo-Nazis, so I think that contributed to it because, of course, for most of mainstream society, we can't imagine that any rational person could adopt a neo-Nazi philosophy. But one of the things that shocked me from the beginning was that this was an incredibly literate crowd. And, when I would go to meetings, what they would be handing me wasn't necessarily guns and explosives. That came later. But when they were first meeting me, it was books and videotapes and newsletters and, sign up for this magazine and sign up for this, which it was, was kind of amazing to me because I had, asked my colleagues in the FBI, what kind of an intelligence base do we have about these groups? And they said, not really a lot, that we're hoping that this investigation will discover some of this information.
That's
so
your
to
job.
See that this was all published, right, that this was all published material that could be read open source, it was a bit shocking, but
really?
It ended up being very helpful to understanding what it was they were trying to accomplish, particularly because one of the things you have to understand about terrorist groups is that they're mostly clandestine. So they don't have a very effective ability to communicate with one another. So one of the ways they communicate with one another is through publication. So their actual terrorist manuals are published material. So they tell you exactly what they're trying to accomplish. And often you have to read between the lines. There's a lot of rhetoric involved. There's a lot of the political or religious or ideological or theological arguments mixed in it. But if you look at it from a methodological standpoint, they really provide the game plan to you. And one of the things that I found interesting about the game plan is the game plan requires the government or the entity that they're attacking to respond in a certain way for them to be able to move to the next stage. And as a counter-terrorist, I thought, well, that makes it easy. All we have to do is not respond the way we want them to, and that will make it very difficult for them to succeed. But unfortunately, even after those cases were over and I wanted to debrief the FBI's domestic terrorism unit about the information that I learned, there really wasn't any interest in that. We made the prosecutions that we made. We sent people who were making bombs and detonating bombs and trafficking in illegal weapons to jail and move on to the next case rather than trying to really understand how we can build an effective counterterrorism policy that's overarching from a national security perspective.
Well, that popped up about three or four questions for me, and I understand some of it might be classified or you might not be able to share it, so just warning the audience ahead of time. Was one of your discoveries the need for media exposure? We hear this debate a lot, whether or not, like with some of the recent terrorist attacks, should we publish it, publicize it or not? I know last year in Nice in France, some of the news outlets were publishing truck kills 84 people or something, but they identified the perpetrator as a truck. So they're kind of really diminishing that. Was that something you found, or can you even share that with us?
Yes. So because these entities are attempting to send a political message, they very much depend on how the media covers them, and that's why, again, it's very important for us to understand what they're trying to accomplish and what they're afraid of. I mean, interestingly, when you look at the terrorists, what the terrorists actually say and write, they recognize that their weakest point is after a successful terrorist attack.
Oh, really?
Right. Which, you know, I was raised, my father was an Army officer, so I was raised in the military, and so, you know, operationally, you think, oh, we have a successful attack, that's when we celebrate. But they realize that that's when they're at their weakest, because they don't choose terrorism out of a hat. It's forced on them by their lack of more significant weapons, right? If an individual has access to a tank and a fighter bomber, he's called a rebel general. He's not called a terrorist. They only resort to terrorism as a last resort. It's an example of their weakness, that they don't have the political means. They can't generate support for their ideas, and sometimes that's because those ideas are suppressed and that political activity is suppressed. But many times it's because the ideas aren't popular. But rather than just acknowledge that, they try to create an environment where their point of view becomes more prominent, and they can do that through an attack. But the attack is creates a public revulsion that, oh my gosh, this was awful. And what they write about is that we need the government to respond in an overly aggressive way that targets innocent people. Because what they're trying to argue is that our group is treated unfairly by the government or whatever entity we're attacking. So, you know, one of the first things they'll do before the attack is write a manifesto describing who is us. And the reason they do that, you would think that's a liability for a clandestine organization, but the reason they do that is because they want to let the government know who to suppress, who to repress, who to take retribution against their community, because then that retribution will generate actual grievance in the community they're trying to influence. So it's very important for them. They can't gain strength from an attack until the government has responded in a way that undermines the government's own legitimacy in the eyes of that community.
They always forget the part that they attacked first, on the grievance part, causing the government to react.
And typically, if you look at their manifestos, they read almost like an indictment, right? They'll argue that, you know, this is our cause, this is our population, and then there will be a list of these are the things the government has or whatever entity we're attacking has done wrong to us. And these are the things that they'll make almost a self-defense argument. You know, we've used these other means. We tried picketing. We tried petitioning the government. We tried all these other nonviolent things. And now we're resorting to violence as a last resort because this terrible injustice has been done to us. So from their point of view, they're responding. But you know, certainly from. Depending on the case and the group, it's often seen as an attack out of nowhere. Now, you know, again, that's why it's very important to understand these various movements in context with the political activity. I mean, a slave revolt in the United States would not be seen as an attack out of nowhere, right? I mean, obviously
Absolutely.
They're being held in bondage against their will, and you know, by the way we think about these things today, they have a right to self-determination and freedom, and their use of violence to rebel against their slave masters would be perfectly justifiable. Of course, the way it was looked at then was not that way, and so, you know, it's very important to have the context in mind to understand how to address any particular violence, because oftentimes the terrorist group doesn't have political support because their ideas are unpopular, and their justification is not compelling. So when those groups engage in some kind of violence, it is, from a reasonable perspective, out of nowhere and totally inappropriate. And I believe that's most effectively through the criminal justice system, and that criminal justice system included proactive approaches like my undercover operation that was able to prevent plots in motion and to stop attacks from happening. So, you know, part of the flaw after 9/11 was that was not recognized that the criminal justice system can be very flexible and proactive, and when used properly, actually combat some of the government excess in retaliation that then only helps the terrorists.
That's an excellent point. It's a great point. I'm going to bring you back a little bit. We got about 5 minutes left. I'm going to remind everybody it's Michael German, the author of the book Thinking Like a Terrorist, Insights of a Former FBI Undercover Agent. You can find him on Twitter at RethinkIntel. Mike, I want to take it back a little bit to the literature. Did you see any classic revolutionary literature?
I did, actually. It was interesting because you would think, especially for white supremacists and neo-Nazis, that they wouldn't look at something like the mini manual of the urban guerrilla written by Carlos Marighella, a Brazilian communist. But again, they were very methodological. You know, that so much of terrorism research is focused on the different ideologies and theologies that drive these groups. But if you look at their methodologies, whether they're communists, whether they're white supremacists, whether they're Muslim terrorists, the methodology is very similar, and they would use one another's and manuals, and they would refer to each other's experience as, you know, the reason we shouldn't do this is because of what happened to that group in Brazil. You know, and what we see effectively that this group in the Middle East did, we should mimic that same methodology and use the same sort of public appeal. You know, this is something that group did wrong. We don't want to repeat that mistake. So, you know, they definitely saw themselves as soldiers that were looking at the operational aspects of what they were trying to accomplish rather than ideologues who were focused on the religious text or philosophies that bound them. Not that that didn't come into the discussion, and not that that wasn't something used to encourage people to participate, but you know, I think our counterterrorist focus on the ideology is misplaced, and we should be much more tightly focused on the methodology.
Let me ask you this. We have two more, three questions. One of them, anyway, we have two more questions in the last couple of minutes. Did you sense any, it sounds like to me almost cultish, and I'm not sure if you've read the book by Singer in regards to cults, but did it have any kind of feel of that?
Certainly there were elements of that, but I think there were elements of that in the FBI as well. Right? I mean, there was a lot of cultural sort of unspoken requirements, you know, down to kind of a uniform, you know, the FBI agent, white button-down shirt, tie, and dark suit, you know, wingtip shoes. So, you know, and especially having grown up in the military, I had always been sort of attuned to that acculturation of in-groups. You know, we're this way, and the way we're going to identify one another is because we're going to have these common attributes and behaviors. So I didn't find that to be as off-putting. I mean, obviously, it took some time for me to understand what their markers were and what was important for me not to violate. They are a relatively small group and do, for the most part, want to be separate from society.
You're slightly disillusioning me. I pictured Derek Morgan from Criminal Minds and the muscle shirts. None of you guys wore that?
there certainly was that. And part of my mission as a law enforcement officer was not to fit in with the group exactly right. I was there to gather evidence about criminal activity. So interested in me, even though I wasn't going to get a swastika tattooed on my neck. So that was part of the creativity of that undercover technique, that I was able to come up with ways to encourage them to want to work with me as a criminal, even though I was not necessarily an ideologue the way that they would expect in the broader movement, right? I let them try to recruit me to the ideology rather than trying to suggest I was one of them.
Good point. Last question before we get to the final question of where we can, what your main point of the book was. The final question for me, do you see any kind of apocalyptic tones at all in the group that you were with?
I think they, well, number one of the things to understand is that you know, even just among the white supremacists or among the anti-government militia types, there were a bunch of different ideologies. So, you know, some of the white supremacist groups were atheists, some were Christian, some believed in pagan religions. So there was a wide disparity in what the separate belief systems were. But what they had in common, you know, even again, as you move to the anti-government groups that weren't necessarily white supremacists, and even to Muslim groups that normally aren't even talked about in the same conversation, it is this sense that the world is on a precipice, and this cleansing war is almost ready to happen. And our goal as a terrorist group is to be the catalyst that pushes it over the edge. And that's why the government response needs to be narrowly focused, because responding with a global war on terrorism is extremely counterproductive. That was exactly what they wanted, and, you know, here we are 15, 16 years later, and the war is much broader and more complex than we would have imagined then, and no end in sight, and this is something that is benefiting them more than it's benefiting us.
Interesting. So it had a little bit of apocalyptic undertones. Mike, what's the main question we always ask? What is your main point that you want to get across to everybody in thinking like a terrorist?
My main point was that a terrorist is trying to have a debate about the legitimacy of the government they attack. So it's very important for the government to understand that and only to use to react in ways that are legitimate, to make sure they are within the law, to make sure that they are proportional, to make sure that they are directed at the people who are doing harm rather than people who just look like those people or have a shared belief system as those people. And that's where I think we went so far off track by engaging in extra legal techniques like rendition and torture and other broad military activities that had a bigger impact on people who had nothing to do with 9/11 than on those who did, and actually helped broaden their base and make it easier for more people to not like Americans.
Excellent point. Michael German, thank you so much, Mike, for being here. We truly appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks very much, and let me know when I can be helpful again.
And we can find you at the Twitter handle at Rethink Intel. That's correct?
Yep.
All right, wonderful. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, this is Michael German, the author of Thinking Like a Terrorist, Insights of a Former FBI Undercover Agent. You can find him at Twitter at Rethink Intel. We thank you all for joining us. I hope you gained as much insight as I did as we continue to learn about the world of terrorism and counterterrorism with leading experts from around the world. Thank you again for visiting us. Remember, you can catch more of our shows at behavioranalysisgroup.com, behavioranalysisgroup.com. Thanks again, everyone.